Welcome to this presentation on relating theory to practice. Let me just put it in context for you. I regularly have the opportunity to talk to groups of people about the relationship between theory and practice, and what's become apparent to me over the years as a result of those conversations is that there's a lot of confusion about that relationship, and in particular about what is meant by theory, how it's supposed to apply to practice, and so on. So what I want to do in this session is to highlight some of the key issues about the relationship between theory and practice, and to put a slightly different emphasis on that relationship, because it's something that's been around for a long, long time. You know, there were debates about the relationship between theory and practice back in the 1970s, for example, and probably before that as well. So what I want to explore is some new ideas around the relationship between theory and practice. But first of all, let's just get some clarity about what the key issues are. So these are the ideas I'm going to be looking at. First of all, the idea of integrating theory and practice rather than applying theory to practice. You're probably familiar with the term of applying theory to practice. That tends to be the conventional term that's been used over the decades. And I suspect that many, if not all of you, at some point in your career, have been asked to apply theory to practice, to think of an example of your practice and then say, what theory did you use in that practice? And I suspect that when you were asked to do that, you found it rather difficult. Now, how would I know you found it difficult without knowing you? Well, the simple answer to that is because fundamentally we don't apply theory to practice. That's not what happens. It's an abstraction. It's a way of putting across the relationship between theory and practice, which I think is actually unhelpful, because it implies that we start with theory and then we aim for practice. And the theory base is so large that's just not going to be realistic. And later on in this presentation, I'll be arguing that what we need to think about is starting with practice and then using theory to make sense of that practice. But I'll come back to that point later. So I'm using the term or the phrase integrating theory and practice rather than applying theory to practice, because applying theory to practice implies that it's a one-way street. Yeah, that theory should inform practice. And I'm not saying it shouldn't, I'm just saying it's not that simple, because I think also practice should inform theory, or practice should at least test theory. I'll just give you a brief example of this. For many years it was believed that when people are grieving, they grieve in stages. I suspect, again, most if not all of you were familiar with the idea that people grieve in stages. Yeah, well, people don't grieve in stages. There is little or no evidence to show that people grieve in stages. And there are now theoretical approaches that have challenged that based on research where people have actually gone out and talked to people who've had a major loss and have found no evidence that people grieve in stages. Lots of evidence that some people try to grieve in stages because they think it's the proper thing to do. But you see how that's different from the idea that the grieving process is one of going through stages. So that's an example of where practice has, in effect, tested, challenged theory and found it wanting. And there is now, as I say, a much better range of theoretical approaches to understanding loss and grief than just the simple idea that it's a matter of going through a particular set of stages. So another important thing to consider is, what do we actually mean by theory? Well, in its simplest sense, a theory is an effort to explain. It's an attempt to explain something. When you say to somebody, what's your theory about what has happened? What's your theory about this or that or whatever? What you're basically saying is, how can you explain it? So theory is basically how we explain things, how we understand the situations that we are dealing with. And so from that point of view, theory can be defined in broad terms. It's ideas that guide and inform practice, ideas that help us make sense of practice, so that when we're in a particular situation, we can have a good understanding of what's going on. Because that way, if we've got a good understanding, we're better equipped to actually deal with the challenges involved in the situation. Going into a complex situation without understanding it, we're setting ourselves up to fail, basically. You know, that we're asking an awful lot of ourselves. And so theoretical perspectives are ways of understanding the situations that we deal with. So that then leads us to the question of why is theory important for practice? And I'm highlighting a few examples here. The first one is what I like to refer to as the fallacy of theoryless practice. And what that refers to is the tendency that's been quite common in some places, at least over the years, for some people to say things like, I'm not interested in theory, I prefer to stick to practice. As if their practice is not informed by any ideas. As if it's just straightforward, so-called common sense. The idea that there can be a practice that's not based on ideas, not based on understanding, is a fallacy, it's a myth. That there has to be some sort of set of ideas underpinning your understanding of the situation you're dealing with. And I would argue that it's better for you to know what those ideas are, for them to be explicit, so you're aware of them, and also for you to then be able to build on those ideas and to test them out where necessary. Whereas if you're not aware of what those ideas are, because you're falling into this trap of the fallacy of theoryless practice and just saying, I want to stick to practice, not interest in theory, then you're using ideas without really being clear what they are. And that's potentially dangerous. And one of the reasons it's potentially dangerous is anti-discriminatory practice. That when it comes to tackling discrimination and oppression, then it's important that we're tuned in to the key issues around that, because as you may well be aware, in my view, most discrimination is unintentional. So for every overt, deliberate act of discrimination, there'll be many more where people didn't even realise they were discriminating. For example, because they were relying on a stereotype, for example, or making assumptions about people without thinking it through. So if we're not clear about what's informing our practice, then we could well be then in difficulties when it comes to tackling discrimination and oppression. So if for no other reason, we need to be aware of what are the ideas informing our practice to make sure that we are in keeping with anti-discriminatory, anti-oppressive practice. So that's important. Then there's also evaluation. And that's increasingly important these days, in these days of cutbacks. Because if we can't show that what we're doing works, then sooner or later we're going to be in a difficult situation, maybe, of somebody saying, well, if you can't show it works, why should we fund it? Why should we pay for this service, this project, this work, whatever it may be, if there's no evidence that it works or it does any good? And if you're not clear and explicit about what you're doing and why you're doing it, do you see how you're not in a very good position to evaluate your work? And if you can't evaluate your work, then as I say, there is a risk that somebody will stop funding it at some point in the future. So evaluation is really important. Then there's the idea of continuous professional development. One of the expectations of a professional is that you get better over time. So for somebody who's in a non-professional job, an ordinary job, shall we say, as long as they do that job reasonably well, then nobody's going to complain. But if you think about it, the expectation is that somebody in a professional job gets better over time. How satisfied do you think parents would be, or how satisfied would you be if you're a parent, if you had a child that's been taught by a teacher who's been teaching for 5 years, but they're no better at teaching after 5 years than they were after 5 weeks? Yeah? So do you see how built into the notion of a professional is the idea of continuous professional development, that the more experience you have, the better you get. that you don't just sort of coast in neutral, as it were. The technical term is it's about avoiding plateauing. You know, a plateau is a flat-topped mountain, so the idea is that people improve until they get to a certain level, and then they don't get any better. They just sort of plateau. They get coasting neutral, as it were. Dangerous stuff, if you think about it. Then also linked to that, linked to the idea of professionalism, is the idea of professional accountability. So as professionals, we can be called upon at any reasonable time to give an account for why did we do something or why didn't we do something, to give a professional rationale for our actions. Do you see, if we're not using a theoretical base, then we're going to struggle to be able to give a professional rationale for what we did. Yeah, we end up with things like, it seemed like a good idea at the time, or that's what we do in our team. Or, I did that once before and it seemed to work okay, so I tried it again. Do you see how none of those would hold any water if you were called upon to justify your actions as a professional? So this idea of professional accountability is important. And then, last but not least, in terms of why theory is important for practice, is the idea of inappropriate responses. And what I mean by that is if we don't have a theory base, or we don't understand our theory base, then we can end up acting inappropriately, that we can end up doing something that is unhelpful. So going back to the theme of loss and grief, which you may have gathered is a particular interest of mine, what's apparent now from research that's been done in recent years, that on average, men and women will grieve differently. So it's not every man and every woman, it's not that simple, but there are gender patterns in terms of grieving. So while most women, and a minority of men, will feel comfortable in terms of talking about their grief, expressing their grief through crying and so on and so forth, the majority of men and a minority of women do not feel comfortable with that type of grieving, that they are happier with what you might call an instrumental style of grieving. So somebody who prefers an instrumental style of grieving wouldn't feel comfortable talking about their loss. They'd rather, for example, mow the lawn twice as fast, or climb a mountain, or do something. That's their way of dealing with their feelings. Now, for a long time, it was assumed that the right way to grieve, the proper way to grieve, was to cry, to talk about it, and so on. Now, do you see how if we don't challenge that idea and recognise it's actually more complex than that, then we could be potentially quite oppressive towards the majority of men and a minority of women who do not want to grieve in that expressive way. They are going to get much more benefit from grieving in their preferred style, their instrumental way. So can you see how not being in touch, as it were, with our theory base, our knowledge base, can lead potentially to dangerous practice? And that's just one example. You know, that if we had all day, I could give you half a dozen other examples, but we haven't got time for that. So a number of important reasons there why theory is important for practice. What I want to look at now is, if it's so important, why does it often not happen? And I just want to highlight a few reasons why it often doesn't happen, that people don't integrate theory and practice, that they just get on with the practice and possibly think about theory afterwards, but are not necessarily using theoretical perspective to give them insights into what they are doing. So just a few barriers to integration I want to highlight for a few moments. First is anti-intellectualism. That, unfortunately, a lot of people seem to think that anything that is associated with the academic world is out of touch with reality. You know, this idea of forget that college nonsense, you're in the real world now, and all this sort of thing. So it's basically saying, forget your knowledge base. Just do whatever you want to. And so that streak of anti-intellectualism is quite dangerous, really, but sadly not uncommon. I regularly come across people who give me examples of where they've been exposed to this anti-intellectualism, where they've been told something like, forget that college nonsense, this is how we do it in this team. So instead of people's practice being shaped by their professional knowledge and their professional values, their practice is being shaped by the culture of the organization or the team that they're working in. They become what I would call a culture victim. And that's a dangerous position to be in, where your practice is being shaped by forces beyond your control. Because if you think about it, an organizational culture or a team culture is just a set of habits. It's just the dead weight of habit, in a sense. So for our practice to be shaped by that rather than by our professional knowledge and values puts us in a very vulnerable position. But the other side of the coin is what I'm calling intellectual elitism. I'm sure you've had the experience, or many of you at least have had the experience, of picking up a book and putting it down again very quickly because it's in code. Yeah? That it's written for people who speak the same code. That it's in some sort of academic or intellectual code that only the initiated are allowed to know about. I had an experience once, for example, of co-writing something with a colleague. I never co-wrote anything with him again. It was a dreadful experience. Because he kept translating the bits I'd written into this code. So, for example, at one point I'd used the word relevant. That, I can't remember what it was now, something or other was relevant. Now, I suspect you all know what relevant means. Yeah. Now, when he looked at my bit and gave me his bit to check over and so on, he changed relevant to apposite. Now, I suspect far more people understand relevant than apposite. So I asked him, why did he change relevant to apposite? He said it sounded better. But you see how it's part of this elitist, intellectual, academic code. Now, I think it's important we have to get the balance right here, because there are two dangerous extremes. On the one hand, there is the rejection of anything vaguely academic as being unreal, of out-of-touch reality, which is dangerous stuff. Because that means, for example, anybody working with children is going to take no notice of attachment, because that's a theory and that's like all that university stuff and you want to forget that. So can you see how dangerous that is to reject the theoretical base? But on the other hand, there also, at the other extreme, is we've got this problem of the intellectual elitism where there is this code that can be very difficult to crack. And both of those can get in the way of us using our knowledge base, of actually drawing on our theoretical knowledge base. Another barrier or obstacle is a lack of confidence. The number of people I've come across who've told me, for example, that they're scared of theory, or they feel uncomfortable with theory, or it makes them nervous and so on, so they feel unconfident in dealing with theoretical issues. And yet I spent much time over the years sitting down with people like that and showing them how they're using theoretical ideas all the time. But they perhaps don't realise that they're using it. And perhaps what's scaring them is this intellectual code in a sense. And so for many years I've said to people, if you pick up a book and you can't understand it, put it down and find another one that you can understand. Don't assume you're thick or you're not cut out for all this theory stuff just because somebody's written something badly. If people can't communicate with you, then don't assume that's because you're somehow not cut out for theory or not very, very bright. It's either that they haven't written it very well, or it's in this intellectual academic code, or a mixture of both, those problems. But either way, that lack of confidence can be a problem. Another obstacle is the vastness of the knowledge base. Because if you think about it, the knowledge base we draw on is actually quite huge. The potential range of issues that inform practice. That's a huge knowledge base that we are talking about. And that's part of the problem with the idea of applying theory to practice. Do you see how, well, how on earth do you apply such a vast knowledge base to one particular situation that you are in? That doesn't make any sense. You're trying to fit something huge into the small entity, if you like, of the situation that you are dealing with. Linked to that is the idea of subject meshing. And what I mean by meshing is the way different subjects come together. So, for example, there will be psychological elements of what we do. There will be psychological elements of, sociological elements of what we do. There will be legal elements of what we do. So can you see how all these different disciplines, all these subjects, have to be, in a sense, knitted together? They have to be pulled together so that we can make sense of them in a way. And that's a difficult task. You know, if you just study one subject, if you study clinical psychology, for example, can you see how, for the most part, you can just focus on clinical psychology? Whereas what we're talking about is a much more complex, much bigger, more diverse knowledge base that we can potentially draw on. And then last but not least, in terms of barriers, is what I like to call pet theory syndrome. And what I mean by pet theory syndrome is that some people tend to stick to a particular theoretical approach as if it is the answer to everything. For example, when I was a student, I did a placement with somebody who was an excellent family therapist. He was superb at doing family therapy. He had a reputation for being excellent at family therapy. The only trouble was, though, that everybody who came his way got family therapied. Whether they needed it or not, whether it was appropriate or not, that was his thing. And to a certain extent, there's a lot of this been going on in recent years about cognitive behavioural therapy, yeah, where it's seen as like the in thing to use CBT, whether that's appropriate or not in the circumstances. So do you see what I mean by pet theory syndrome? You know, if we're not careful, people jump on a bandwagon, that then gets in the way of us drawing more holistically on the range of theoretical ideas that are out there. Okay, so we've looked at what theory is, we've looked at why it's important for practice, we've looked at what can get in the way of relating theory to practice, of integrating theory to practice. What I want to look at now is what is in some ways a new perspective on the relationship between theory and practice. And it comes back to something I mentioned before, which is the idea that instead of starting with theory and applying it to practice, what we need to do is start with practice and then theorize it. Yeah? In other words, draw on our professional knowledge base to make sense of that specific theory. So there's that huge knowledge base out there, but instead of trying to squeeze it all into the current situation when much of it will not be relevant to the current situation, what we're doing is trying to tailor the knowledge we need to the specific circumstances that we are dealing with. So we begin with practice and then draw on theory as appropriate. So if you are dealing with a particular situation, you need to be thinking about what is it about my knowledge base that can inform me in relation to this situation. So if, for example, you're dealing with a situation where there's conflict involved, then you will need to be thinking about, what do I know about conflict? What insights around conflict do I need to take account of when I am working with this person? If you're working with a person or a group or a family or whatever, where their cultural or ethnic background is different from your own, what do you need to know about those issues where you are working in a sort of cross-cultural way? What needs to inform your practice there? Now that links in then with an old idea, which is a reflective conversation with the situation. Now, as you may or may not be aware, that's a phrase that comes from Donald Schoen, who is one of the people who's most closely associated with reflective practice. People often refer to him as the person who invented reflective practice, which is not true. He was writing about it from the 80s onwards, and the term reflective practice was actually used as long ago as 1916. So he didn't invent the concept of reflective practice, despite what some people say. But he did do an awful lot to make it as well known and as widely used as it is now. And one of the phrases he used to explain reflective practice was the idea that we need to have a reflective conversation with the situation. And what he meant by that is we need to be, if you like, engaging with our professional knowledge base as we're working through this reflective conversation. So, for example, asking ourselves, what's going on here? What's my role in this situation? Are there any risks involved in this situation I need to be aware of? What other factors do I need to be aware of dealing with this? What pitfalls do I need to be aware of? Now, I'm not suggesting those are the precise questions you need to ask in every situation. I'm just giving that as an example of a reflective conversation with the situation. So instead of just reacting to it on the basis of habit or team culture or not knowing what else to do, it's about asking ourselves, what do I need to know to deal with this situation? Now, the idea of mindfulness is very popular these days. You know, there's all sorts of courses around mindfulness, books being published about mindfulness. It's quite an in thing. And I would want to link mindfulness to this idea of the reflective conversation with the situation. So the idea is, as you're engaging in a practice situation, you're doing so in a mindful way, that you are alert, you're tuned in. One example of this, for example, would be around what I like to call emotional competence, dealing with the emotional dimension of situations. Because, of course, there are two sides to that. There's partly about being able to read the emotional signals that other people are giving you, but also being clear about what emotional signals are you giving off. And are they helpful, or are they potentially making the situation worse in a sense? So having that alertness, that awareness, being attuned, if you like, to what's going on is partly what mindfulness is about. And it's also partly what this idea of a reflective conversation with the situation is about. Now, I've worked for many years doing, amongst other things, expert witness work. And this has become an issue in many of the cases I've dealt with, where I've had cause to interview someone and say to them, why did you do that? Why did you take that course of action rather than this? And it saddens me that so often in those situations, I can't get a sensible answer. Yeah? That there is no clarity about, I did it because. Yeah, I thought about this and then I used my knowledge about that. Actually, if you like, surfacing the knowledge, bringing the knowledge to the surface to make it explicit, I acted because of this, that, or whatever. So many people struggle to do this. So that takes us back to the professional accountability issue, you know, that we're going to struggle with feeling confident and comfortable with our professionalism if we are not able to give a professional rationale for what we do. And then last but not least, in terms of theorizing practice, is I want you to picture the relationship between theory and practice as a vertical one, not a horizontal one. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is the traditional idea is there's a horizontal relationship, a flat relationship, if you like. So theory's over there, practice is over there, yeah? Theory's in the university and in the textbooks. Practice is when you go out on placement or when you're qualified in the so-called real world. Can you see how that tends to be the traditional way it's seen? As they are almost like separate spheres. And for me, that's dangerous because then they don't connect up. That people will focus on theoretical ideas when that seems to be appropriate to the context. And then they will focus on what they see as practice issues when they're in practice in that sort of context, but without referring back to the professional knowledge base. And what I would say is if we're not drawing on that professional knowledge base, what's the point of having it? Yeah, that we're wasting our time developing that knowledge base if we don't actually use it. But if instead you think of it as a vertical relationship. And what I mean by that is theory underpinning practice. Yeah? That practice, if you like, rests on theory. So as we are practicing, we're digging into that knowledge base. We're drawing on that knowledge base. So theory underpins practice rather than being a separate domain from practice. And if we can get into the habit of thinking of it that way, I don't know about you, but I think that's a much more helpful way of understanding the relationship between the theory base, our professional knowledge base, and our actual practice, is to understand it as that sort of vertical relationship where theory underpins practice rather than this traditional horizontal relationship where they're seen as like two separate worlds in a way. So just to pull it all together then, just to conclude, and then we'll have time for some questions and discussion. This is a saying that used to be used quite a lot many years ago. Don't hear it so much these days, which is a pity because it's important. And that is, theory without practice is useless. Practice without theory is dangerous. Yeah, so having a knowledge base that you're not using is not useful. There's no point having it. It's like having, you know, a PhD in nuclear physics and then doing nothing with it, just sort of parking it somewhere. Having the knowledge base that you don't use is pretty useless, really. It's just no help. But the other side of the coin is that practice without theory is dangerous. In other words, if we're going into situations and we don't understand them, we haven't got a knowledge base to draw on, then that puts us in a dangerous position. Now, I'm not for a minute suggesting that you need to be experts in theory. That's not what it's about. It's about having at least a basic knowledge of the key ideas that inform the work that you are doing. So just very briefly to sum up, then we'll see if you've got any questions or comments. What I've tried to put across is the traditional idea of applying theory to practice is, in my view, problematic because it assumes that you start with theory and aim for practice. If we fall into that trap, then we're not going to be using theory. They'll be separate. And that's dangerous because, as we've seen, there are a number of ways in which it's important to recognise the value of theoretical understanding for practice. We've looked at some barriers that can get in the way of that, and hopefully forewarned is forearmed. You know, if you're aware of those barriers, you're less likely to be a victim of them, be better equipped to navigate around them or to remove them altogether. And what we've also seen is that, coming back to this idea that applying theory to practice is problematic, that what we need to think of instead is the idea of theorizing practice. In other words, we start with practice and then draw in a vertical relationship, draw on the professional knowledge base underpinning it. Okay, so hope that's helpful. Thank you.